Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books and Gender Studies. I am the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. This is a special edition in collaboration with the Society for U.S. Intellectual History. Today, my conversation is with Mary Griffith, the John C. Danforth Distinguished Professor at Washington University in St. Louis, where she directs the Danforth Center on Religion and Politics. From her most recent book, Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics, published by Basic Books, is the topic of this show. Griffith provides a portrait of how religious views regarding sexuality became entangled with multiple political debates, including those over feminism, gay rights, sex education, and in charges of communism and secular humanism. Beginning with the controversies over birth control in the 1920s, she takes us through the 20th century to the most recent battles over same-sex marriage dividing American Christians, both politically and religiously. Moral Combat features pivotal figures, including birth control advocate Margaret Sanger, the fundamentalist radio preacher Billy James Hargis, and the first gay Episcopal bishop Gene Robinson. She demonstrates how pro and con positions were not always clearly defined, and adherents could change sides in a matter of a decade, finding surprising allies. In the new millennium, two distinct religious visions for society and human sexuality had taken root, unraveling any hope of consensus. Here is my conversation with Mary Griffith.
Now let me introduce you to the author, Marie Griffith. Hello, Marie.
Hi, Lillian.
Welcome to the show, and thank you for sharing your thoughts with our audience. Your book paints a portrait of 20th century America where there was a fundamental and unprecedented split among American Christians in regard to sexuality. But let's start, before we get into the book, let's start with you telling us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to write Moral Combat.
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It's a great chance for me to get to talk about these things. I'm from Chattanooga, Tennessee, originally, and grew up Southern Baptist, and I guess I've always been interested in religion. My mother was a feminist, and so I've always been interested in religion and gender and how those things sort of combine, Southern Baptist and feminism in her case. And, I guess throughout much of my life, I've just noticed that so many controversies over sex seemed to play themselves out in Christian communities, not always the ones that I was a part of, but, you know, just looking out there to the wider world. And so I was always interested in this question of why is the so-called religious right seemingly obsessed with gender roles and, female submission to male authority, where they've been concerned about that, or, you know, and then actual sexuality and practices of sex outside of marriage, same sex, stuff. So, you know, this book in some ways has been in the making for a very, very long time as I've sort of worked my way through those questions.
Now, you start with the birth control movement with Margaret Sanger. And the question that came to mind when I was reading that chapter was, why did birth control become such a controversial topic? I know that Margaret Sanger wanted to change the cultural conversation, but before her, what was the cultural conversation? Did anybody talk about birth control?
Well, that's just it. I mean, birth control was sort of a mostly forbidden topic. Anthony Comstock had sort of made sure of this through the Comstock laws that prevented a lot of things from going through the mail service and being publicly discussed, including birth control. So you might, in a doctor's office, if you had the right kind of doctor, a doctor might talk to you very carefully about birth control. Certainly, there were methods that were available then. But there was no public conversation about it at all. And so really what started the controversy was Margaret Sanger and a few others, but she's, you know, kind of the best known, who began saying, this needs attention. This needs public attention. We need to reach the people with this message.
I was wondering when I was reading it, how many people actually, I know you don't talk about this, but maybe you found it in your research, how many people actually use birth control on a regular basis in terms of percentage? Was it mostly a middle class or upper middle class or educated population?
Yeah, that's a great question because, and this is not a history that I've done myself, but just reading the broader literature in this, I think the sort of sense is that a lot of women from all social classes sort of passed along knowledge of, you know, how to prevent pregnancy. So, you know, I think various methods that would seem very primitive to us today were commonly used. Illegal abortions, of course, were not that uncommon. And, you know, there was always the man stopping before ejaculating to prevent pregnancy, right? So, you know, I think there were all kinds of ways that people would find to prevent having a pregnancy. But, you know, again, a lot of this didn't work, of course. Many methods weren't very effective at all.
Now, Margaret Sanger was able to work a wedge between Catholics and Protestants regarding birth control. And she kind of used anti-Catholic arguments to persuade Protestants to her cause. What was going on there?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that was still a period of very strong anti-Catholicism, particularly in sort of affluent white Protestant circles. Catholics were, you know, largely seen as immigrants and, you know, dirty people coming over from Italy and, you know, various Catholic countries. So there was a lot of very strong and really quite open anti-Catholicism at that time. But really, Margaret Sanger, I would say, didn't exactly start the quarrel with the church. In some ways, the church started the quarrel with her by preventing her or attempting to prevent her from speaking publicly about birth control. I tell the story in the book about a 1921 conference that she organized in New York, and she was supposed to be the culminating speaker. And when she got to the lecture hall, the doors had been locked against her, and the police eventually arrested her when she tried to speak anyway. And it later turned out that the local Catholic Archbishop of New York, Patrick Hayes, had somehow someone in his office had played a role in that. And boy, then she just milked that for kind of public sympathy very effectively. And the newspapers were outraged that she had been prevented from speaking. And it really did. At that point, she very successfully sort of corralled American anti-Catholicism, you know, for her cause.
Now, what was the position at this point between the difference between the Catholics and the Protestants in response to birth control? Where it seems to me like you're saying that the Protestants were more open to considering this, besides just, you know, believing sort of she needs to have the right to speak because, you know, we have a right for speech here in America. It was more than that.
That's right. I mean, my sense is that the church, the Protestant churches weren't speaking on birth control at all. You know, there certainly wasn't a strong sense of this as a terrible thing in some theological way. I'm sure there were many ministers, you know, who frowned upon it or whatever. But just judging by birth rates and other things, you know, it clearly birth control wasn't really a big issue among Protestants. If among Catholics, of course, the very strong assumption was, you know, opposition to birth control. But, you know, it really took Sanger in this public conversation almost to force different religious groups to take a stand and not stand by silently as this controversy took place.
So it's one of those things that Protestant bodies didn't talk about. They kind of knew it was going on, but nobody really addressed it. And it was sort of kind of a secret, even in the churches.
Yeah, I would say that's true. And if there was a dominant view, it was probably an opposition to birth control. I mean, just as sort of a general kind of principle. But it strikes me that it was very rarely, certainly it was very rarely talked about publicly in Protestant circles.
Okay, we go from birth control, which just seems like a very personal, private issue, to a much broader issue in terms of censorship. Because, you know, her speaking out and talking very publicly about birth control raised concerns about could the government censor people's speech about sexuality and those kinds of things? So, how did this feed sort of this opposition to censorship? But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of things happening. Literature and new movies are coming out now, and you've got mass culture, more dissemination of sexual topics. So, how would you describe the government's attitude towards this, censoring these kinds of things, and how the industry, you know, particularly the movie industry, began to move to self-censorship as a replacement for government censorship?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Well, so, you know, the 1920s and 1930s, as you say, saw somewhat more open discussion of sex and sort of its presence in various modes of entertainment became somewhat more prominent. And, you know, before it was really regulated, there were some pretty risque things that, you know, were coming out in Hollywood movies and that sort of thing, risque by their standards, maybe not so much by ours now. And so again, it was really, it wasn't the government initially that stepped in quite so much as, you know, religious people themselves who didn't want their children to see such things. They didn't want their children reading certain types of books or literature. So a number of organizations were really focused quite heavily on censorship. The Women's Christian Temperance Union, which is known for its anti-alcohol stance, was also very focused on censorship at that time. And then a couple of very important Catholic organizations were created that really focused on both literature and the movies. And, you know, even the early Hollywood kind of screening system and rating system for movies was very much influenced by some Catholic players who played a very important role there and worked with movie producers and all to keep certain themes out of the movies and try to keep them pure.
Now, one of the people in the second chapter, you talk about censorship, you talk about D.H. Lawrence, which you make him sort of a central figure because of his literature. Can you talk about why you chose him? What is interesting about Lawrence that kind of feeds all this debate?
Well, Lawrence is just so interesting because he was censored over and over and over again, and he just fought it. He fought it, and he wrote about it, and he spoke about it, you know, just endlessly. And because he was considered by some people a great writer, you know, one of the great writers of his time, you know, these issues got an awful lot of attention. So the issue, the sort of moment I focus on with him is when he publishes Lady Chatterley Lover, or tries to publish Lady Chatterley's Lover, kind of gets some expurgated versions out there at least, and immediately, you know, it's forbidden. And I tell a story about a bookseller in Cambridge, Massachusetts, being tricked into selling a copy of the book to someone who turned out to be an undercover censor, member of a censorship organization, and a trial resulted in prison terms and all that. So, you know, and then since censorship, of course, of Lawrence went on and on and on. But, you know, the themes of his novels, if anyone's, you know, still reading his novels, there's a lot of sex in the novels. But he always wanted to say, look, this is not pornography. I'm not writing about sex in order to titillate people. I'm writing about its beauty. And Victorians have just killed the notion of the beauty of the human body and the beauty of sexual love and this uniting between people. So he really felt like he was sort of rescuing the holiness of sex. He really saw it in very religious terms, too.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting that he did see it that way. And it seemed like after him, some theologians came after him who kind of said, yes, you know, sexuality is not a dirty thing. You know, there's a sacredness to sexuality. And he sort of kind of opened the way of people thinking about sexuality in a very different way, not just as something about the body, but spiritual, kind of religious. It was not Protestant religion. It wasn't Christian religion, but he did seem to have a religious impulse in his view of sexuality.
Oh, yeah. No, very much so. And even on into the 1960s and 1970s, the sort of liberal theologians, many liberal theologians of the time, just revered Lawrence for, you know, sort of recognizing and celebrating the sacredness of sex.
Now, we've talked in the film industry, we have Will Hayes and the Hayes Code. Can you explain to the audience what the Hayes Code was? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, the Hayes Code was just an attempt to, it's one of these attempts, again, to sort of clean up the movies and prevent certain kinds of things from being a subject of movies or being shown. So, you know, what women could wear, you know, sort of part of the Hayes Code, the themes that were not allowed. So they didn't want anything like adultery as a theme in a movie unless it just was absolutely essential to the plot and it couldn't be, you know, sort of celebrated in any way. It had to be frowned on. Interracial relationships were forbidden by the Hayes Code and, you know, any number of other things. It was very lengthy, actually.
What was really interesting is that once you have mass entertainment and you're dealing with issues of sex, all of a sudden you got the issues of race get wedded to the issues of race, like it's always been, but all of a sudden shows up on the movie. It shows up in the movies. And so I wanted to ask you about the next thing I wanted, it was Ruth Benedict. And I didn't realize that her work on culture had led to her work on race. And how did she challenge, who was she, and how did she challenge so-called American sexual values?
So Ruth Benedict was an anthropologist at Columbia University, and she had became famous when she published a book called The Patterns of Culture. And I start writing about her in about 1941 during World War II. She actually did a bunch of work for the federal government on sort of race and racial issues. And one of the things that she did was author a pamphlet called The Races of Mankind, that essentially argued that race is a construction. It's a human construction. There's really no such thing as a race or as different races. We are all mixes of something, you know, if you call it a race. And therefore, there was really no problem with loving people and marrying and reproducing across the so-called color line. The pamphlet was produced and distributed actually to the armed forces, because members of the sort of armed forces service committee wanted to reduce racism even in the army. They wanted to help white men who were fighting alongside Filipinos in some cases and help them think differently about, you know, the terrible Nazi ideology and the dangers of kind of, you know, racial science. But it really backfired, and a huge controversy erupted from some senators and congressmen in the Jim Crow South who, you know, were scandalized by the kind of interracial dimension of her work.
Well, it seemed like communism and race mixing kind of got together there. Anti-communism. What was it? It was like it was a communist plot, or what was the idea there?
Yeah. So she was accused of being a communist, and others who had those ideas. And this was before the McCarthy hearings, of course. This is still, you know, early to mid 1940s. The idea was communists are infiltrating America in ways we can't even see. They're here and they're among us, and we don't even know who they are. But one of the things that they, one of their weapons, if you will, is trying to, you know, kind of mess with the morality of Americans and get them to lead these sort of debauched lives and more focused on their erotic life than on other things. They'll sort of suck them in and distract them from political work. So yeah, she was seen as being part of this kind of, you know, almost communistic plot to destroy America.
Now, the highlight of your book, maybe not the highlight, but the turning point, it seems to me, was the chapter where you talk about Alfred Kinsey in his work on the sexual response and sexual habits of Americans. It seems to be that, I think it was in 1953 when his book on the female sexuality came out. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like he was a turning point. And I don't know why it felt that way to me, but it did seem that way. Can you talk about Kinsey and why he was so pivotal in this whole thing? And what did he have to do with religion?
Right. Well, yes. So Kinsey really did these two studies he did, 1948, sexual behavior in the human male, and 1953, sexual behavior in the human female, became bestsellers. I mean, they were everywhere. And every American magazine, American newspaper gave enormous coverage to these books when they came out. They were just, and that's the reason that this becomes, you know, such a turning point, because nobody could ignore him. You know, in the past, certain figures might seem kind of marginal, or you could just ignore them. At least the mainstream media wasn't necessarily celebrating them in this way. But here, the mainstream media, you know, just loved writing about Kinsey and did it a lot. And so really, what happened, it sort of spawned a very divided reaction among American Christians. Conservative Protestants and Catholic leaders denounced Kinsey as immoral. They felt that he was, you know, writing about sex in such a way that was degrading to the morals of America. It insulted American women to suggest that at least half of them weren't actually virgins when they married, you know, these kind of scandalous claims of the book. So they denounced him over and over and over again, quite loudly. And then the interesting thing about this is, though, you also had a liberal Protestant and to some degree liberal Jewish response that was much more positive towards Kinsey, that felt like there were actually pastoral applications to his work, that if we can simply learn from Kinsey, learn how people are really living, what they're struggling with, same-sex desire, you know, especially was one of the big ones, we can actually help our parishioners. So that's the moment when, you know, as much as any, that you see a deep divide among American Protestants, you know, that's just really stark, and this larger divide that of course is growing into our culture wars at that point.
Now it seems like he was garnering, he was looking for religious leaders to support his work. Why is that?
Why was he looking for religious leaders?
Yeah, why? Because he's a scientist. I mean, he's working as a scientist, and he'd gotten so much opposition, but he's at the same time really trying to continue to dialogue with religious leaders.
Right. Well, you know, it was a pious moment in American history, you know, and I think he was savvy and knew that his work was going to have a far greater impact if, you know, some of the clergy and you know, theological leaders, you know, were actually on his side. But actually, I say that, and that's true. But on the other hand, a lot of clergy just reached out to him first. You know, I spent a long time, I visited the Kinsey Archive archive at Indiana University a number of times and spent a lot of time in his looking at the correspondence in his archive. And I mean, it's clear clergy from all over the country, from cities, from tiny little towns, all in every state practically, wrote to him first and said, thank you for writing this study. I'm really taken by this. I realize that my parishioners are struggling with things, and thank you for making this easier for me to understand. And he was a crazy correspondent himself. He wrote back to all of these folks, you know, and so he sort of developed relationships. But in many ways, they came to him first, an awful lot of them did.
The issue of this also gets into now into the issue of sex education or education of about sex in public schools. And you talk about this Mary Steichen Calderon. Is that her name?
Yeah, Steichen.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never heard of her. And so I was, tell us about her. And what was she a liberal or was she a conservative in regard to sexuality? And how does she promote sex education? But she seemed to have some conservative views and some liberal views.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, Mary Steichen Calderon, she was actually the daughter of the photographer Edward Steichen. So she sort of grew up in this sort of elite kind of intellectual world. But as an adult, she was a physician. She worked for a time for Planned Parenthood as its medical director, first woman to serve as the medical director of Planned Parenthood. And then she left Planned Parenthood to start the Sex Information and Education Council of the U.S., or CECUS, which is an organization that's still very active even today. And it was an organization that really wanted to support organizations that wanted to put together sex education programs. You know, the state of sex education in the public schools and really everywhere, she thought was just a disgrace. And young people weren't learning the right things from their parents or from their congregations, and certainly not from their schools. But an awful lot of folks at that time really wanted to improve sex ed, you know, for whatever organization they were a part of, and CECUS was really there to help them do that.
Okay, so this is going to be huge because, of course, you're talking about parents and their children, and once you start messing with somebody's child, people get really upset. So you got Billy James Hargis, who is really opposed not only to sex education, but he is opposed to a lot of other things that revolve around sex. What was his influence and what was his message?
Sure. So Billy James Hargis is a fascinating figure. He was a fundamentalist, anti-communist preacher from Oklahoma originally. And he was known for a lot of things. He did a lot of anti-communist activism and all in the 1950s. But eventually he discovered Mary Steichen Calderon and CECUS and was outraged by this, you know, what he saw as promotion of immorality. And he spent all kinds of time and energy and ink denouncing her and this organization in no uncertain terms, and really inspired, a sort of counter movement to her in all kinds of ways. So, and he had many allies in that, the John Birch Society and various organizations, you know, really went after her quite viciously, to be honest. So they would go to towns where this was becoming a topic and a controversy, and they would go to churches and speak to people and really sort of help develop local movements to oppose sex education in the public schools. And, you know, I looked at her correspondence files too, and she got some vicious letters. I reprint a couple of them in the book, and it was quite astonishing. So yes, the work she did could not have been more controversial at that time, and of course remained controversial for long after.
Well, the whole thing about sex education, what I was wondering about is, what was the content of her sex education? I can't imagine that it was very radical or outrageous as we would think of it today, but nothing's outrageous anymore. So I'm just kind of wondering what the content was.
Right. Well, and again, she was always quick to say, I'm not developing the curriculum. I want to help school systems that want to develop curriculum, and then we'll work on that together. But she was very medically focused. So she wanted their, you know, diagrams, and she wanted the proper words of genitals to be spoken and to not be sort of forbidden. You know, she was really very matter of fact. And of course, there was nothing that she really wanted to talk about in terms of morality. You mentioned earlier, you asked me about her being somewhat conservative and somewhat liberal in different ways. And, you know, one of the more conservative ways, I guess, is she was very much a proponent of monogamous lifelong marriage. She had difficulty with homosexuality. She evolved somewhat on that in her lifetime, but she, you know, always kind of found that bewildering and problematic. And she did not like the kind of hedonism that she saw around her in the 1960s and so-called promiscuity, you know, as she called it. So in some ways, she was also advocating for a very traditional kind of, you know, model of sexual relationship. And I think the programs probably reflected that quite a bit.
Okay, so we've got, it seems like the issues are getting more complex as we go along. Because in the book, it just gets more complicated. Now we're, you know, you're talking about abortion, and we know how complicated that is. So, and the history of abortion in America is complicated just in and of itself, because it was not legal, it was not regulated, and then it was illegal, and then it became, it's not all one straight line. You know, it was always illegal. Can you talk a little bit about the history of abortion, like in the 19th century, and then it was in certain states it was banned, and when you could have an abortion, and what were the positions of doctors on this?
Yeah, sure. Well, so abortion is as old as pregnancy, probably. You know, attempts to get rid of a pregnancy go way, way back. And midwives and folk healers and all kinds of folks have always had, you know, some kind of different ways of helping women terminate a pregnancy. It really didn't get regulated and made illegal until the middle to the late decades of the 19th century. And that really was around physicians, who were sort of trying to, you know, establish their own medical authority over midwives and over folk healers and others. So that wasn't a difficult fight. So abortion gets pretty much made illegal in most circumstances. Each state kind of regulated it slightly differently. So I think all states made some provision for the life of the mother, that it was acceptable in those cases. And then different states had maybe other exceptions as well. So there was a lot of variety in that. But over the course of the 20th century, especially starting in the 50s, a number of physicians and other and social workers, frankly, became very concerned because they were seeing so many women still getting illegal abortions. And of course, you know, oftentimes becoming very, very sick or destroying their own future fertility or even dying from illegal abortion. So a movement really emerged among professionals to say, we've got to do a better job. This needs to be, you know, more medically accessible in more cases to prevent, you know, this kind of situation. And Americans themselves, especially during the 1960s, really held a view very similar to that and wanted there to be greater access to abortion, at least in certain circumstances. So by 1972, I think it was, Gallup does a poll, and the majority, the clear majority of Americans, including a majority of Catholics, by the way, favored some degree of abortion reform. So in 1973, when Roe v. Wade comes down and sort of really suddenly makes abortion legal in all kinds of, you know, circumstances for the first and second trimester, the country, that most Americans had been ready for some kind of abortion legalization. Now, that went farther than a lot of people thought it should go, of course. And from there, a very, very vigorous anti-abortion movement arose, as we know.
But what happened quickly was that abortion was not just about the fetus, the life of the fetus, or when human life begins. It really became an issue about women. in the feminist movement that was in, you know, pro-family and what this was doing to sexuality. It was a bunch of issues all around abortion that was beyond, you know, affirming the life of a fetus.
That's right. And that's one of the points that I really want to make in the book. You know, I'm well aware that for many people who have strong anti-abortion views, this is about life and death. I completely understand that for many people, they see this as murder. And, you know, there's that. But in addition to that, there have always been, I think, these other sorts of you know, ideas bound up in it and a kind of hatred of feminism among many of these same folks. Strong anti-abortion sentiment has typically gone along with anti-LGBT sentiment. In other words, a sort of range of attitudes towards sex and gender, and a range of conservative attitudes around sex and gender and even gender hierarchy and all have tended to go along with that pro-life position. So in that chapter of the book, I'm trying to kind of unpack all of that.
Yeah, and it seems like the language was very much part of this, the language of how each group talked about the other group, like pro-choice, pro-life, anti-choice, anti-life. You know, it was like pro-abortion. It was all this vocabulary that was thrown at each other to kind of recast the other party in an unfavorable light.
Well, I think that's right. And, you know, to me, the abortion debate has been a tragedy in all sorts of ways, no matter what side you're on or what you think about it. And partly, you know, this inability or unwillingness to sort of see the moral values that are animating, you know, the other side, whatever side you stand on. So, yeah, the kind of weapons of, you know, calling the other side names and making assumptions about who they are, you know, has really been part of this, making it just an impossible debate, you know, where compromise feels almost impossible. So that was not the case in 1973. It didn't have, you know, that polarization really developed over time, sometime after that.
Now, we know it kind of in the history of the Christian right, the Roe v. Wade was a very big galvanizing decision by the Supreme Court, and that it really was very much a driving force to get Christians to get politically involved. But we don't hear that much about the pro-choice clergy. Okay, and their role. In particular, you talked about Howard Moody. So let's talk about him and his clergy consultation services and what the pro-choice clergy was doing.
Well, so Howard Moody was a minister, originally a Southern Baptist from Dallas, and he was based at this point in the late 60s in New York City at Judson Memorial Church down in Greenwich Village. And he also he did a lot of work with the poor and really saw, again, a lot of women in dire straits with unwanted pregnancies, pregnancies they couldn't afford, pregnancies that had resulted from rape or from a husband that was leaving them or was abusive or something like that. And so he joined with a number of other clergies to provide an abortion referral service that started in the early 1970s prior to Roe v. Wade. And, you know, that was really an attempt to find providers who could provide safe abortions. And, you know, of course, essentially they were breaking the law by doing this, but the law kind of let them go on the most part. And they worked with all kinds of women. They really saw it as a justice issue, as an issue of standing with the women the way that Jesus would stand, you know, with the poor. And so they very much saw this as a Christian mission, you know, and I take them at their word in that. I mean, it was very much part of a Christian vision of justice and standing with the poor.
So how did, there's another thing it went into. Howard Moody went into this attempt to alleviate basically the stigma that was around prostitution.
Yeah, so he also, yeah, his prior work had been with prostitutes in around New York City. Absolutely. And he just felt like, you know, here are the pariahs of you know, our society who are suffering and are in need of, you know, assistance. And they're not only suffering, they're human beings, you know, and he developed friendships and you know, with these women, and really, yes, tried to have a whole different attitude toward prostitution than pretty much the rest of American society.
Now, this is happening. He's a Protestant, so, but there's the other side, which is, I think, a really interesting story about Catholics and how that movement began, the Catholics for Choice, and that was a much more difficult trail to forge for them because the church was very, very strong.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And this was a movement sort of spearheaded by Francis Kissling, who's very much still alive and active today. And she wasn't by any means the only one, but she sort of helped, became the leader of this organization that was called Catholics for a Free Choice early on, and then Catholics for Choice. And, you know, her argument was, look, the Catholic Church, there's not just one Catholic position on abortion. There is also a Catholic position that sees standing with women and standing with the poor as a religious vocation, and that does not believe that abortion is murder, flat out, period. And so, you know, she and a number of other people, men and women alike, really worked amongst other Catholics, you know, on that. And sometimes they worked in abortion clinics. They did some political work. They worked with Geraldine Ferraro when she was the vice presidential candidate in 1988, and sort of supported her she was the first Catholic to, you know, really go public as a pro-choice Catholic. So, you know, they did a lot of good work like that, that was sort of, you know, intended very much to be, you know, driven by Catholic values, but interpreted differently than the church did.
Okay. Now the abortion issue was an issue that was really hot, and it seemed to kind of cool down, and sometimes it just keeps coming back. But I'm wondering about, now that we're going to go into sexual harassment, I'm wondering how the current situation in sexual harassment, all we hear on the news, is really sort of a replay of what you talk about in the 1990s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, how today's stories are sort of
hearing and Paula Jones and Bill Clinton. It seems like at that time, the way you describe it, that the, you know, feminists and women were very like, we got to stop this. We're going to do something about it. There was a rally of we got to stop sexual harassment, but it seemed like nothing much happened. And now we've got dealing with it again.
Well, you know, that's kind of the story of sexual harassment in some ways, is that it sort of emerges into public view when a particular case catches the eye of the media and the American people. And, you know, there's a lot of outrage and a lot of activism. And, you know, after the Anita Hill accusations against Clarence Thomas, the number of charges of sexual harassment, I mean, women became emboldened for some time to sort of make these charges public and you know, get the law involved and that kind of thing and really correct this. And, you know, the Paula Jones case also, you know, people against Bill Clinton, people talked about sexual harassment. It was now the conservatives were talking about it, which they didn't during Anita Hill's sort of moment. So, you know, but then, yes, the sort of public outrage dies out. And you know, we've seen nothing like that until the recent sort of charges and the Me Too movement that kind of began when Harvey Weinstein and some of these big famous guys were outed. And of course, that movement is still very much alive now.
And of course, you know, I think it happened back in the 90s, because I remember people say this is going too far. You know, these charges of sexual harassment is going too far. So now we've got the same, we've got another, you know, oppositional movement saying women are going too far with this Me Too. You know, we're taking, you know, good men and we're running their careers and character through the mud. And now they, you know, this destroys their careers. It seems like it's just a rerun. And it's rather disturbing. We know as historians that history is not supposed to repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme.
It does. It does. Yeah, that's right.
So now, you know, we come to today, which is really what you end up talking about, the same-sex marriage, which, you know, if we thought abortion was, you know, controversial, boy, this one, this is the end of civilization, okay? So let's talk about the attitude And I think a lot of people don't realize, a lot of people think that it was gay people who decided that they were going to pursue same-sex marriage because this was the way to legitimize their lifestyle. But you show that there were many gay people who were not interested in this issue. How did it become an issue that was, yeah, that it was popular or became accepted across the board?
Yeah, and this is a complicated story that there are new books devoted to this that I think people can get a far deeper history, you know, of that question. Yeah, on the one hand, there have always been gay couples who sort of wanted to get married. And you know, I document some of those, you know, throughout the 20th century, even before that, and have wanted this. But, you know, this was never a big issue, a sort of mobilizing issue at all. And I think a lot of folks in that community would say, well, we were just trying to, you know, fight for our lives. We were just trying to stay alive and not be killed, you know, or not be thrown in jail or, you know, have another Stonewall riot with the police after us. So, you know, there were bigger priorities, in other words, for a very long time. But, you know, the issue of marriage, I think, was very much seen as a civil rights issue. And a number of legal thinkers, you know, coming out of law schools and other sorts of things, really looked deeply at the law and I think began to see that, you know, an argument was possible that could really work, you know, at this level and make, you know, all people be able to have this equal right to get married. And that has financial implications for people. It has tax implications. It has implications for what happens when one person dies and who inherits what, you know, and that sort of thing. So, you know, it was a movement long in the making. And, it was never embraced by everyone, or it was never enthusiastically embraced by everyone. A lot of people thought that it had this normalizing tendency and just going to make gay people look like straight people and that it was really dull, you know, and boring. But I think all would say, you know, even if so, you know, there is a need for equal civil rights.
And also it was interesting, you know, there's a lot of feminists who are against marriage altogether. And they just thought, I mean, marriage, why? And what's interesting, too, this is at the same time the marriages, heterosexual marriages are falling apart. So it's like, why marriage is falling apart? Other people are just, you know, trying to get out of marriage. Other people are trying to get in. So there's...
Right, right. Oh, yeah. And there were a lot of feminists and others and lesbian activists who just rolled their eyes in the 70s at the idea that, you know, marriage was something to fight for. So it really didn't gain momentum until a good bit after that. I write about it more, you know, really in the early 21st century. I mean, that wasn't the beginning of this movement, but that's where it really heats up, you know, all over the country.
So there was also some intermediate approaches to same-sex relationships, short of state-recognized marriage. There were some religious attempts to kind of provide some sort of intermediate communal affirmation.
That's right.
Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah. You know, I tell a bunch of stories of clergy who, you know, kind of with their couples who wanted, you know, who were very religious and who sort of wanted to have a union that would be blessed by their religious community and that would be somehow recognized in the eyes of God. So, you know, there are a number of ceremonies like that that I documented, and I'm sure far more than I did, you know, of really different sorts of ritual ceremonies that would take place in religious settings as part of a blessing the community would give to the couple. So those things were happening long before, you know, marriage was actually legal.
Well, you know, I remember when I was reading the court decision, same-sex relation, marriage was approved by the Supreme Court, and it seemed like the positive decision for it really talked about marriage in a sort of a transcendent sort of, you can't really find fulfillment as a human being unless you're married. I thought that the language of the court in that decision was way overblown, particularly since marriages are falling apart all the time. We have divorced parents, single parents, lots of studies saying that single people are even happier than married people. You know, So it seems like at the same time that reality seems to say that marriage is not enduring as a cultural institution, you've got the court making this very romantic painting a romantic picture that allows for same-sex marriage, which is kind of, I think it's kind of an interesting, it's ironic. There's a disconnect there between what's going on with the culture and the law.
Oh,
wait, yeah. Tell me what are you thinking about this?
Oh, yeah. Well, you're not alone in your skepticism, you know, about that. But, you know, and I think a lot of people, you know, just kind of said, well, we'll take it. You know, that's not exactly how we see marriage as this transcendent institution, but we'll take it. You know, marriage is really, there's really two things we're talking about. We're talking about marriage. We're talking about the civil institution. And then we're talking about the sort of religious, you know, side of it. And those often have been conflated because a lot of people, most people still, I guess, get married in congregations, or, you know, an awful lot of people do. So you think of it as just one simple thing when it's really you're kind of, you've kind of got two different things going on. But, you know, I think that it's ironic maybe, but that way of seeing marriage as being so sacred that everyone should have access to it, you know, that had power in some circles. I think that was very effective, you know, in sort of persuading some unlikely people to become supporters of same-sex marriage. So, you know, even if people roll their eyes at some of that, you know, it seems to have had some value in changing attitudes and then changing, you know, the law.
I think there probably was a rush of same-sex couples rushing to get married right away. But, you know, I kind of wonder where the statistics are now, whether, you know, they're just more like heterosexual couples, a lot of cohabitation, you know, divorce and everything else. So it's kind of interesting. Okay. So let me ask you, I would have a final question for you. So how do you, all these debates about sex education, abortion, contraception, same-sex partnerships, I mean, censorship, huge, huge issues that have to do with sexuality and how we're going to order our society, and particularly the position of women and all these issues, create this huge, you know, breach you talk about between and within Christianity, which had never really been seen before like this. The Christians had divided upon other things. Well, they divided on abolition, slavery. But this was really close to home. It was really personal. And I was just wondering, is there any way, do you think, to heal this breach? Or now we've got, you don't talk about this, but now we've got transgender rights, okay, and the debate about that, in terms of what is a man and what is a woman, and are they just God made two genders, and or now that, you know, we can have four or five. And so can this breach ever be healed, or are we just irreconcilably sort of split? As you know, the Christian community split on this.
Yeah. So just to go back, you're right. You know, there was a consensus at one point in time among most Americans of all kinds. You know, if you look at the very end of the 19th century, early 20th century, that marriage was monogamous, heterosexual, meant for life. There was gender hierarchy. Men are the head. Women, you know, answer to the men and raise the children. I mean, these kinds of things weren't liberal or conservative by their standards. That was just, you know, reality. That's how they saw it. They saw it as a God-ordained institution. And so then skip ahead and into our own time. And yes, there are still folks who believe that, but, you know, it's completely split. And, you know, to the folks who don't believe any of that now, you know, that all of those kinds of assumptions about marriage and gender and sexuality have really gone by the wayside. You know, can the breach be fixed? It's hard for me to see at this moment in time an end to what I see as sort of the patriarchy that is still driving some of this on the one side. I don't see, you know, certain church communities budging on their position on women, for instance, women in ministry, or, you know, kind of the notion about God created two genders. And this is how it is, and this is how it will always be. You know, I don't see that changing doctrinally, you know, anytime soon at all. So what I think you have to hope for is are better ways of communicating across these gaps, of really communicating the moral values that are animating your own beliefs, and accepting the moral values that are on the other side, and somehow being willing in the law, in the legal sense, to find some way to manage these and compromise where you can compromise in order to live together. I mean, our society is so polarized now. It's a terrible problem. It's one of the, it's the biggest problem I think that we have. And, so somehow finding ways of living together with people that, you know, we might believe very, very different things about, you know, it's an urgent task. And I am hopeful about that. I'm hopeful when I see the younger generations and they have a passion to do that. So I don't know if I think that everybody's going to somehow agree on transgender issues, or that everyone's suddenly going to become a feminist and on gender issues. But I do think we'll find ways to live better together.
And you know what happens, Marie, is you can't live in a silo. Everyone, no matter what their position, is going to run into this, into their own families, with their neighbors, with their friends. They're going to run into one of these issues or more of these issues that they have to deal with on a personal level. So, you know, you can have theoretically a position, but when you really deal with it personally, you think, oh my goodness, this is real. You know, my son or my daughter is gay, or my daughter got an abortion without telling me. You know, you have to make decisions in real life. So anyway, thank you, Marie. You've been very generous with your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was really fun talking to you, Lillian.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in Gender Studies. This has been a special edition in collaboration with the Society of U.S. Intellectual History. This is your host, Lillian Barger.